Good evening, and welcome to Health Matters. I'm Dr. Sanford Katz, and I'll be your host for this Health Matters when we talk about headaches and migraines. Headaches is one of the most commonly experienced of all physical discomforts. About half adults have a headache in a given year, and tension headaches are the most common, affecting about 22% of the population, followed by migraine headaches, which affect approximately 12%. Overall, there are more than 200 different types of headaches. Some are harmless, and some are life-threatening. Yet only approximately 1 to 5% of people who seek emergency treatment for headaches have a serious underlying cause. The description of the headache and the findings on neurologic examination determine whether additional tests are needed and what treatment is best. Frequent headaches can affect relationships and employment, and there's an increased risk of depression in those with severe headaches. One type of severe headache called migraines affects more than 38 million people in the U.S. and can be some of the most debilitating type of headache. But new studies have helped physicians to know more about what happens during a migraine and have led to new medications. And since proper medications can help headache sufferers function better in their daily life, it's important to have an evaluation by a physician to determine the type of headaches you're experiencing. To learn more about headaches, I'm joined in the studio tonight by neurologist Dr. Deborah Davis, professor of clinical neurology at LSU Health in Shreveport, who specializes in headaches. Welcome.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
We also have Dr. Jessica Wilden, a neurosurgeon and director of Tri-State Neurosurgery, which is associated with Willis-Knighton Physician Network.
Hello.
Welcome. Yes.
Thank you.
Welcome. And we have a neurologist and pain management specialist, Dr. Randall Brewer, who works at River City's Interventional Pain Specialist. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
People may recognize Dr. Brewer's voice. He is, of course, one of the hosts of Health Matters, but tonight we get to have him on the other side, and I get to ask him questions. And, of course, our listeners get to ask questions because this is a live show, and we will be taking calls during the show at 1-800-552-8502. So, to get started, Dr. Davis, what exactly is a headache?
It's an ache in the head. It's head pain. It can be due to a myriad of causes. One of my favorite headache specialists once said that you could have up to 500 diagnoses that cause headache. So it's pretty nonspecific.
So a pain in the head, let's say. Okay, I guess that's self-explanatory,
yeah.
Right? But now, how do you know, you said it could be lots of different causes. So do we have primary headaches and secondary headaches? That means
headaches that just... Yeah, that's pretty much how the classification goes.
Could you explain the difference between those?
Yes. A secondary headache is something that is caused by something that you can find on, say, imaging, such as an MRI or a CAT scan or an X-ray, something a dentist might find in your mouth cavity, something, you know, caused by sinus problems, ear problems, eye problems. A primary headache tends to be either hereditary or just evolving for an unknown reason, and we call that idiopathic. And those are the ones that I see more often because other doctors take care of those other problems.
So when you say primary headache, you mean, like, can you give some examples?
Yeah, sure. The primary headaches are mainly three major ones, probably the only ones that we'll talk about tonight. Tension-type headache that you mentioned is the most common, but not the one that people see a doctor for because it's not disabling. Migraine, which we'll talk about a lot later, and cluster headache as well. So those are the three major primary headaches. There's also new daily persistent headache now, and a couple of other smaller ones.
Okay, so what kind of headache would the not tonight, honey, I have a headache? Now, that would that be a persistent daily headache, or would that be primary or secondary?
It could be any of them. You just don't feel good when you have a headache. But oftentimes it ends up being a migraine because migraines are disabling.
Okay, and as far as secondary headaches are concerned, what sort of things, Mike? You mentioned sinus, I think.
I did. Although oftentimes sinus pressure and migraines are confused, and so because you can have pain that comes down into your face and neck with migraine as well. So an actual sinus headache is usually just associated with a true infection.
Okay, because you hear a lot, oh, I have a sinus headache, I'm going to go get sinus, you know, it's my sinuses. Is that necessarily a sinus infection, or people just, it's a headache and they were trying to figure out why?
Yeah, that's really why they should see the doctor, because it is important to make that distinction.
Okay, so how do you know if a headache is serious enough to go see the doctor for?
If it's bothering you frequently, if anything is new that you haven't been experiencing in the past, if it's something that hasn't, you know, you don't know about because none of your family members have ever had it, and it's interfering with your life, you're not able to function, or it just hasn't gone away.
Okay, and the most common headaches, I think you said, the daily persistent, the migraine. Did you mention cluster?
And cluster.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what distinguishes each from each other?
Well, the tension type headache is basically what people think of as a headache. It's just, it hurts because it's aching. It's all over the head. It feels like a pressure. And there's really not much else that happens with it. Whereas a migraine is a brain dysfunction where the patient can't think straight. They can't tolerate normal light or noise. They get nauseated and they have a throbbing headache. The cluster headache is taking all that and compressing it down into one area around the eye, and it's very, very severe and very, very short compared to migraine. The cluster headache only lasts about 3 hours, whereas a migraine can last hours to days.
Okay, and what about daily persistent
headache? New daily persistent headache is extremely interesting and very difficult to treat. This is a headache that can be of any nature, and it occurs out of the blue often to the patient, but they can tell you the exact day and sometimes the hour that it starts, and it never goes away. So it's rather odd. It may be associated with viral meningitis or something that is never diagnosed, and we treat it oftentimes like we treat chronic migraine, just because we're trying to dampen the pain.
Okay, and now that's regular, everyday, non-serious types of headaches. I mean, certainly migraine can be disabling, no question about that.
Right.
But now, a lot of times people have these severe headaches, particularly if, let's say, it's the first time. Let's say it's their first migraine, which, as you know,
that can be scary.
Be scary, right? So, are there any red flags that that would send somebody, let's say, to the emergency room, or should certainly alert them to think, hey, this is something I need to have addressed? What do you think, Dr. Wilden?
Yeah, sure. I think it's fair to say if you and I are meeting because you have a headache, we're probably not going to be in a great place, because I'm a brain surgeon, and that means that we have a reason for your headache structurally. So if you have a very severe headache and it's your first one, it definitely is not unreasonable to seek urgent care. If you are a headache person and two scenarios arise, for instance, you're having a headache that is not like your typical headache, or you're having your typical headache, but it has not responded to the things that usually treat it, those are also appropriate times that maybe a migraineur would come to the emergency room for evaluation. Other times that you might want to think about coming, even if it's not your first severe headache, is if it's the worst headache you've ever had, what we would call explosive or violent headache. Maybe you vomit a little with it and you're having difficulty standing. That type of violent, sudden onset headache can be an indicator that there's bleeding in your brain. And you get bleeding in the brain from a variety of reasons. Some people can bleed into the brain due to very high blood pressure. Other people have abnormalities with their blood vessels, like aneurysms or vascular malformations that can spontaneously bleed. So definitely a violent headache, especially if it's associated with nausea, vomiting, and any neurologic problem. And by neurologic problem, I mean maybe your spouse is looking at you and they're like, you know, your face is drooping on one side, or your eyes are different sizes. The pupil portion of your eye is different one side to the other. Anything like that, weakness in the body, you've lost your grip on one side, your speech is slurred, anything like that should be considered a true emergency during which you need to seek urgent care. Without a doubt, those neurologic signs are telling you and the people around you that this is an emergency. It could be a stroke or a brain bleed. And the important thing to realize about some structural headache problems is that most of them have fixes. So if there's bleeding, we can evacuate it. If there is stroke, we can pull out the clot. If you have an aneurysm or a hole in your blood vessel wall, we can plug it. So there are usually fixes to structural headache problems, which is why you should seek care and not wait. Now that I've scared everyone,
yeah, sure.
Realize that as ERs everywhere, yeah, listening to this show are filling up.
Well, no, I think it's
most
important.
Most people will not have that. Only less than 10% of people seen in ERs will end up meeting me or one of my colleagues for a true structural issue. But like we always say, you know, better safe than sorry, because these are fixable problems a lot of the time.
Sure. Well, you know, I mentioned during the intro that a very small number or small percentage of people who go to the emergency room with a headache, there's actually a serious underlying cause. So we certainly don't want, you know, people to now rush to the hospital. I'd like at the end of the show for people to be able to know, you know, most of the time, hey, this is either serious or maybe this is not serious. And hopefully by the end of the show, they'll be able to do that. So the ERs will only be crowded for an hour. Dr. Brewer, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, just what Dr. Wilden said was a great summary of the red flags, the things that we think about in neurology. A new headache in someone who's never really had a bad headache is a big deal, especially in an older person. There's something called temporal arteritis, inflammation around the blood vessels that is easily treatable. That's a big deal. So something that's unfamiliar and anything that's new and different about a headache or a headache in someone who's not accustomed to getting headaches, because they're headachey people, and then there are people who are not really headachey people. And if you are not a headachey person and you have a really bad headache, you need to get checked out for that.
Now,
if
how
that makes
you
any sense, Dr. Davis, I know you've seen a lot.
Yeah,
here,
a
here.
Lot of these. Yeah.
How are you defining old?
I would say over 50. Most migraine people, you know, people with migraines or if you're going to be a New Delhi persistent headache person or, you know, a person that's inclined to have headaches, you probably know that by the time you're 25 or 30. It's rare for migraines to start in anyone, you know, over the age of about 25 or 30. It's sort of like epilepsy. It's extremely rare. So if you have your first seizure and you're 50, or your first really bad headache that keeps you from home from work and you're 50, then you probably need to see the doctor for that.
Sure.
Even though these are common problems, headaches are exactly, you know, but, you know, it's really the quality and you know, the person that's happening in. The other thing I would say is that a couple of, you know, instances in my career, I've had people who had had migraines and, you know, they also had a migraine with, you know, a stroke. And so, Dr. Davis, you might, you know, recognize this as well. Even a bad migraine needs medical attention, so don't just sit on it.
There's no reason to,
right,
you know, nowadays. And
right,
actually,
absolutely.
Yeah, about a third of stroke patients have headache. It's just that it gets sort of lost in all the other badness that's going on.
So this is good. As Dr. Wilden was saying, let's cover some of the other red flags. The first one that you mentioned that was excellent, over the age of 50, severe headache. What about somebody who has a very sudden onset headache, what is known as the thunderclap headache? What exactly is that?
Yeah, like we were saying earlier, a really violent thunderclap headache is classically associated with bleeding into the brain. A typical workup for that in the emergency room, they would admit you, and they would typically do a head CT. It's a fast scan. It's an easy scan to obtain, and it's a very sensitive and specific scan for new bleeding in the brain. And if you have very severe headache and it has not responded to standard headache treatment and your head CT is negative, you still may have bled and it may not be bad enough to show up on CT. And in that situation, your ER doctor will typically offer to do a spinal tap on you. And the spinal tap is very sensitive for bleeding that cannot be seen. So those are the two tests that you could expect if your history and physical exam were compelling for new bleeding into the brain. On Dr. Brewer's note of being over 50, I did not mention and should have, if you have a history of cancer and you have new onset headache, definitely seek help as soon as possible. As you may know, and as many people unfortunately have personal experience with, when you have any type of cancer, many of them can eventually spread to the brain. And so in the older population, that is a major cause for new onset headache in a person who does not traditionally have headache.
Yeah, and I want to add, that actually includes melanoma. So if you had a melanoma skin cancer, even many years ago, you thought it was completely removed, you had no further treatment, and you all of a sudden have a really severe headache or you're having something unusual, that's something you should have evaluated.
Breast and renal cell, right?
Breast, renal cell, sure. All of these are, you know, commonly can spread to the brain.
And Dr. Davis gives a lecture to the medical students and residents about the parts of the head that hurt, that can hurt. The brain's not really one of them unless something gets big enough to actually push on a blood vessel or the lining of the brain called the meninges. That's why the inflammation of the outside of the brain is called meningitis. The meninges, there's three layers of them, but the outer two layers, what's called the subarachnoid space where all the blood vessels are, and then the thick one, the pachymeninges or the dura mater, they have a lot of pain receptors in them. The blood vessels have a lot of pain receptors in them. But actually, if you go below that into the brain itself, Dr. Wilden could tell you, you can pick on the brain all you want with forceps and bipolar electrocautery, and nobody's going to complain about pain unless you stimulate.
Yeah,
but
right.
Which you know a lot more about than me, but. Dr. Davis, if you will summarize the structures in the brain that can hurt, so maybe people can understand why a sinus headache is so painful, or why maybe, you know, pain with the temporal muscles are so painful, and things along those lines.
Yeah, sensory nerves that go to every single tissue in the head and neck. And so, you know, the mucosal line sinuses, the teeth, the ear canal, the tympanic membrane, which is, you know, the eardrum, the orbit of the eye globe, all the different areas, all the structures, even down to the lining of the bone called the periosteum.
So I know some of our listeners are wondering, what causes brain freeze then?
That is really interesting. And if you have migraines, you're more prone to brain freeze. But it's actually stimulation of the palate that's very close to a nerve called the trigeminal nerve in the brainstem. So we don't exactly know what it is. It hurts, I can tell you that.
Yeah. Oh, I know.
Is that what a cluster headache feels like, though? Like a brain freeze that lasts 3 hours?
In one eye?
Yeah.
Could be, because it is so strong.
Right. And the patients say, there's like, there's an ice pick stuck in my eye.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's the same
sort
of neuropathy.
They call cluster headache the suicide headache, because it is so very, very intense. And patients that have cluster headache get agitated. And so they want to do something about it.
Yeah. You mentioned ice pick in your eye, which reminds me of for those who may not have seen it, Game of Thrones reference, but we'll get back to that a little bit later. I want to give the phone number for people to call in again. It's 1-800-552-8502. Dr. Brewer, you mentioned, I think it was you, who mentioned meningitis. Okay, you hear a lot about that, especially kids going off to college and things of that sort. Say a little bit, you said the inflammation of the lining of the brain. Let's say somebody had I don't know, a generalized infection, maybe a flu, their neck starts getting stiff, they have a headache. When would somebody think, well, maybe this could be meningitis, or maybe this person has meningitis, I need to get them to the emergency room?
Meningitis is typically, headache is probably the earliest symptom, one of the first symptoms that that you would get. And that's commonly associated with a fever.
Okay.
And so the blood vessels in the scalp are going to dilate to evaporate moisture, obviously, and that helps to control fever. And so it's normal to have a headache when you have fever. So most people who have meningitis also have a lot of neck pain, and photophobia tends to be, you know, part of that triad as well. So fever, headache, and neck pain are the things that, you know, associate with meningitis, especially neck stiffness. Viral meningitis is much more common than bacterial meningitis. As we know, you know, we prevent most of the bacterial meningitides with vaccinations now. So we give children the vaccine that prevents, what's that, what's the childhood meningitis that used to be so common that we vaccinate kids for now?
Neisseria.
We give, where's Dr. Bocchini when you need him, right? Yeah, Neisseria meningitis, pneumococcal meningitis for older people now. Right. So we give vaccines for a lot of the bacterial diseases that cause meningitis. But with the flu, with any upper respiratory virus, you can get a headache and you can get some viral inflammation as well. You probably see this more commonly than I do, taking a neurology call, Dr.
Yeah,
Davis.
But actually, they usually don't end up in my clinic because it's, you know, it's basically infectious disease. But anytime you have a headache that's different, that you don't recognize as something as your norm, and anytime you get fever or any kind of illness or feeling ill, that should be a red flag.
Okay. Now, what about exertional headaches? I mentioned the ice pick and the Game of Thrones reference earlier.
Oh, yeah. Do giants get headaches?
Well, they get really big ones. And you know how you treat
just
it
curious.
With big pill. We have Emilia Clarke, who plays Daenerys on the Game of Thrones. And apparently, during the filming of Game of Thrones, I guess it was maybe season one was the first time, she had severe headaches when she was exerting herself during the filming, and it turned out she was diagnosed with an aneurysm. And then apparently it happened again. Dr. Wilden, you were shaking your head. Are you familiar with this story?
Yeah, I'm familiar with her story. I would say that's not an incredibly common presentation to have headache during exercise, but again, not all of us film movies,
right.
So or TV, and it might be kind of extreme compared to maybe what the average Joe is doing at the gym.
I got you. Well, she walked through fire.
Yeah,
so,
exactly. Yeah. So if you're walking through fire and you're really stressed, then we do know that significantly exciting or stressful situations can trigger a weakness in the blood vessel wall to burst and bleed into the brain. And those weaknesses in the blood vessel wall are called aneurysms. So it's not uncommon to hear, you know, we're not talking about moderate exertion like the gym, but like people say after sexual intercourse, I had the worst headache of my life, and that ends up being a ruptured blood vessel. Or somebody says, and we used to see this all the time when I was taking acute call, someone would get into a trauma and someone else in their family would be extremely upset and end up having a subarachnoid hemorrhage or a brain bleed due to a ruptured aneurysm. So it is definitely possible that filming is so extreme that it falls into that category of just a significant physical or emotional exertion, which can be a trigger for brain bleeding if you have a pre-existing weakness in the blood vessel wall.
Yeah, you mentioned headaches associated with sexual activity, but some of the drugs, Viagra, Cialis, and things like that can cause headaches too. It's a frequent side effect, I understand.
If you do go to the doctor and they don't find an aneurysm and they don't find any problem, no bleeding in the brain, and you find that this happens frequently, there is something called exercise-induced headache, which was one of the more benign headache conditions and can be treated with certain types of medications. So, you know, do go get checked out, but that doesn't mean you don't have the condition if it doesn't turn out to be something drastic, which hopefully it won't be.
I think that's a sort of a hypersensitivity state. You know, when you have cranial vasodilation, some people have that, their muscle, you know, they have more blood flow in their muscles, more blood flow in the pericranium. Those dilated blood vessels stimulate pain receptors that cause headache. And it's just like a fibromyalgia of the head. You know, they get I see a number of patients that have very limited pain tolerance to, you know, to various things, and that's one of the things that we see fairly commonly in our clinic.
Yeah. I have Beth on the line from Shreveport. Beth, welcome to Health Matters. What's your question about headaches?
Well, thank you. It's not actually about headaches, but I was hoping I could sneak right in here. My stepmother had C. diff about 2 years ago, 2 to 3 years ago, and she was in the hospital for 2 months, and the only thing that helped her to survive was these just intense doses of different antibiotics. She was told at the time that could cause a problem with the brainstem, and now ever since that happened, she's had permanent dizziness. And I'm wondering if she's waiting on an appointment now to see a neurologist, but she's had all of the balance tests and all that, and I'm wondering if those two can be related, damage to the brainstem and dizziness.
Dr. Davis, I'm going to ask you to answer this important question quickly, because I know we have other folks on the line who want to get through and ask some questions about headaches.
It is absolutely true. The doctors don't tend to use those medications as often that can really cause that are toxic to the inner ear, but I'm thinking perhaps that's what happened. Probably the neurologist will be able to answer more specifically after a good examination, but unfortunately, they may have had to resort to one of those older medications that we usually avoid nowadays.
Yes. You know what? I think that might be the case. All right. Well, thank you for taking my call.
Thank you very much, Beth. Good luck.
Alrighty.
Okay. Well, I think we talked a lot about non-migraine headaches, but of course that seems to be the most common in terms of the disabling headaches. So I'd like to move our discussion into that. And Dr. Davis, I understand that is a particular area of research of yours, or at least focus in your clinical practice.
Yes.
Okay. Well, before we get started, I want to give our listeners a taste of some of the music that we made available for you this evening. And any callers who want to call in who can name the group that plays this, we'll figure out and you'll win a prize.
I've got a migraine, and my pain will range from up, down, and sideways. Thank God it's Friday, cause Fridays will always be better than Sundays, cause Sundays are my suicide days. I don't know why they always seem so dismal. Thunderstorms, clouds, snow, and a slight drizzle. Whether it's the weather or the letters by my bed, sometimes death seems better than the migraine in my head. Let it be said what the headache represents. It's me defending in suspense. It's me suspending.
Okay, anyone? Anyone? I'm going to give first crack to the people here. Anyone know the song? Or at least...
Not a clue.
No? Dr. Brewer?
Let me guess. Migraine. Does it call it migraine?
It's a good guess. Good guess. Anyone? All right, good. So it's open for any callers to call in, and we'll figure out some prize for you.
I really liked one part of that song.
The one I just played?
Yes.
Okay.
This person that wrote it has migraines.
Yeah.
Because they tied in the weather and how much the weather seems to trigger migraines. Every time there's a thunderstorm, everybody comes down with a migraine. And
Now, why is that?
It may be barometric pressure. It is a little controversial. I personally believe it. I see it all the time in my clinic. And it's probably barometric pressure related, because if you go in an airplane with low pressure, same thing happens.
I see. So what are some of the other triggers for migraines?
They can be diet related. And unfortunately, you know, the wonderful wine and cheese that we all like to have after a stressful work day can give you a headache. The triggers tend to build. And so if you happen to maybe be about to have your period, that might not be the best time to have that wine and cheese. Processed meats, deli meats, changes in routine. To tell you the truth, anything can be a trigger, because these patients genetically just have a very hypersensitive brain to the environment, and it can be inside their body or outside their body. So any big changes.
Yeah, it's really a sensory processing disorder at some level.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And now I'll share a personal story. I was in my 20s, my mid to late 20s, and I was an intern. And this was back when we used to be up 36 hours straight working, no sleep, you know. And I remember driving home after being up so many hours, and I started to lose depth perception. And I had to move over to the side of the road, and I don't know what it was. It was just very strange. It was just some weird changes in my vision. And I was fine for about 30 minutes or so, and then, boom, I got a horrible headache after that. And it's happened to me two or three times in my life, and usually when I'm very sleep-deprived. Now, I assume that was a migraine, right?
It sounds very much like
throbbing, pulsating, something like that type of headache, that was what's called an aura. Right?
That is right.
Okay. And can you talk a little bit about, because I understand that there, some of these migraines are associated with an aura and some without an aura.
About 15% or so of patients that have migraine can have aura, but it doesn't mean that they have it with every headache. And it does seem to be coming from the cortex, and it is a wave of abnormal function of those cells and abnormal processing, such that oftentimes it starts in the back of the brain where we process our visual information. So it's usually something that's a visual distortion, just like you had. And it can then be also sensory. You can have a numbness or tingling. And it usually lasts about 30 minutes at the most. It can go on longer. Sometimes patients have headache afterwards. Often they do. Sometimes not. I actually have had two or three auras in my life and never have had a migraine headache.
Really? Now, is there anything you can do to abort that migraine before it hits?
Well, our migraine abortive therapies can work pretty quickly, but usually if you take it in an oral form, not quite that quickly. But there's nothing wrong with taking your migraine medication that early. It won't hurt you to do that. And it seems to work better the earlier you take it. Once that avalanche starts, it's hard to stop it.
Okay, well, you know what? Very exciting. We have a caller with the answer to my question. Let's see. This is fun. Sarah. We have Sarah from Louisiana. Sarah?
I'm probably wrong, but is it M&M?
Oh, I'm so sorry. It's not M&M. Okay. But, okay, I'll give you a second chance. How's that?
Okay.
Okay, so the media went crazy over the unsubstantiated claim that a Daith piercing could help prevent migraines. Where is the Daith located? I'm going to give you, it'll be multiple choice, okay? Is it between your nostrils? Is it the right eyebrow? A cartilage fold in your ear, or middle of your tongue? The Daith.
The second one.
The right eyebrow.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. First off, I have to say there's no evidence to support this, but many people claim that the piercing the innermost cartilage in the ear has helped their migraines, and that's based on points targeted by acupuncturists to relieve pain. So, but I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to give you a prize, but I do appreciate you calling in, and that was an excellent guess. Do you have a question for our doctors while you're on the phone?
No, but I'm going to stay tuned to find out who was singing that.
Okay, fantastic. Thanks so much for calling in.
Thank you.
It's interesting you mentioned that. Migraine, you know, has made its way into our art in so many different ways. I mean, it's such a creative song that this group came up with. Apparently, the writer of Alice in Wonderland had migraine.
Lewis Carroll.
Lewis Carroll.
Very good.
And you know how Alice has some serious sensory perception issues, and you know, it could be that his personal experience with migraine influenced his writing of that particular story.
Well, Dr. Brewer, actually, there is something called the Alice in Wonderland syndrome. And it is a migraine aura where patients see things get smaller and smaller and smaller, called micropsia, or bigger and bigger and bigger, called macropsia. And it doesn't even have to be the whole object. It can be just part of somebody's face that you just watch grow. It's rare, but there you go.
Neurologists love to talk about it.
Ooh, we have another guess.
We not only treat disease, we admire it, correct, Dr. Davis?
Yeah. You have to love what you do.
So people who get migraines, it usually starts at a younger age, I understand.
Yes, it can start even in infants.
Now, does that mean that they're going to get headaches their entire life, or can they potentially grow
out
of
it? It's in their genes, but sometimes genes express themselves at different age groups, so you can never tell.
Yeah. What about foods like Chinese food or artificial colors, preservatives?
Anything really. And what I do is I just ask people to be cognizant, mm-hmm. and maybe keep a little diary about, you know, what they may have eaten in the last 24 hours. But it's so hard.
Yeah.
We eat everything. I tell you, you know, MSG is a trigger for some, not for others.
Yeah.
One thing that's really interesting is that chocolate is often considered a trigger. To my knowledge, there's only been one research study that looked at chocolate as a trigger, and they did heavily minted chocolate and heavily minted carob, which is a plant that's
sure.
like chocolate, and they gave it to migraine patients, and they didn't find any difference between the two. Would you like to guess where the study was taken place?
Switzerland?
Hershey, Pennsylvania.
Oh, how do you like that?
Major conflict of interest there.
Very funny.
Yeah, thank
you. Yeah. Okay, we have another caller on the line. We have Elizabeth from Bossier City. Elizabeth, welcome to Health Matters. How are you?
Hi, thanks. I'm well. How about yourself?
Good. Did you call in with a question for our panel, or a guess about the music?
Yes, I think I have the answer. Is it Migraine by 21 Pilots?
That is correct. Congratulations. Very good. So you,
awesome.
Yes. Do you ever listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me?
I do. It's one of my favorite programs.
Oh, well, that's wonderful coincidence, because that's your gift. We're going to give you a Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me mug.
Awesome. Very cool. I'm super
excited. And you can drink, do you drink coffee?
I do.
Do you suffer from migraines?
I fortunately do not, but my husband and my little sister both do. So I definitely monitor what they're both putting in their mouth, because caffeine is a trigger for both of them.
Really? Because caffeine can actually also help to treat migraines. Is that correct, Dr. Davis?
Yes, it is. There are so many different mutations that are probably expressed as migraine. We may be dealing with so many different, you know, subsets. So I never tell patients that something is not a trigger. If it's a trigger for them, it's a trigger.
It does bring up the point that migraine is extremely hereditary.
Elizabeth, thank you very much for calling in and for guessing that or knowing the answer to that song. You have good taste in music.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye. So, it's interesting, the caffeine thing. I guess it's, I don't want to give name brands out, but I mean, all right, it's Excedrin. Okay, it's Excedrin migraine. And that's what, aspirin and caffeine, right? Isn't that what's in Excedrin migraine, I believe?
I think, and probably some acetaminophen with it.
Even one of the most commonly prescribed medications for headache called Fiorinol or Fioricet, mm-hmm. Dr. Davis is, you know, to her dismay, it's a very, very commonly used medication. It has a barbiturate, butalbital with caffeine and aspirin in it as well. And it's prescribed by physicians, yeah. But the caffeine's a very, it's a commonly used analgesic in other parts of the world and other things as well. You can see caffeine sold with aspirin and other NSAID combinations in other countries. We just don't have that here, but yeah. it has analgesic properties aside from its vasoconstrictive properties and, you know, stimulation, obviously.
So let's talk about
the pathomimetic properties.
So let's talk about some of the treatments. For migraines. Someone has migraines, it's starting to become problematic. They say, okay, this is interfering with my life, with my job, my family, what have you. I'm going to go to the doctor or diagnosed with migraines. What might be one of the first steps in terms of medications that would be prescribed?
Generally speaking, patients have already tried the over-the-counter medications because Excedrin does work for mild migraine. Research has proven that. And so after those types of medications, I often want to give the patient a preventive medication in order to sort of calm that nervous system down, because as Dr. Brewer said, as a sensory processing disorder, they're hypersensitive to everything. And in addition, give them something to abort the headache when it comes, because they have this fear that this headache is going to come and ruin their date, ruin their meeting, ruin their work day, ruin a trip to Disneyland. So they need something to stop it. Nowadays, we use the triptans. The first triptan came out in 1991 in shot form. And there's seven of them on the market. We use a few more commonly just because the insurance companies like the other one, those brands. But we have choices. And they generally can stop a true migraine within a matter of an hour or two. We can also use anti-seizure medications to decrease the frequency of the migraines, anti-inflammatories, and other medications which may alter serotonin receptors, etc. There's a new generation of migraine preventives that is out now. If you want me to go into that,
sure. They're new.
Well, there's an inflammation that happens in the covering of the brain that Dr. Brewer mentioned, the meninges, during a migraine, and a certain peptide gets released called CGRP. The CGRP antagonists are now commonly used for prevention for migraine. The first one came out a year ago. We have three at our disposal, and these are monthly injections of a monoclonal antibody to CGRP or the CGRP receptor.
So this is target, and let me interrupt you for a second. People hear a lot about targeted therapy, and as an oncologist, there's all sorts of targeted therapy. Radiation is targeted therapy. Some of the immunotherapies for cancer targeted specifically towards the cancer. The rheumatologists now have medicines. Many of them are monoclonal antibodies, which are basically protein medicines that work like your own immune system. And so now it sounds like neurologists now have these targeted therapies.
Yes, and we're using some for other disease states which do decrease the immune system, but the migraine monoclonal antibodies, you're right, they use that state as a GPS system to get that molecule to the place that it needs to be, the CGRP or the CGRP receptor. And that's all that the monoclonal antibody's job is just as a GPS system. Does not decrease the immune function at all. And there's actually absolutely no FDA contraindications to taking it, and no drug interactions.
Yeah. Because I know some of the triptan medicines that you mentioned have some side effects that some people find unpleasant.
That's very true. And not only that, unfortunately, a very small amount of vasoconstriction can occur in the heart with the triptans. And so if you've had a stroke or if you've had a heart attack, you really should not take them at all. There's a new set of medications that are called the gepants. They're not out yet. They're in the research conveyor belt, but we're hoping that one of those might be used for patients that have had stroke or heart attack to abort a migraine. And then there's also another medication as well called a 5-HT1F agonist. And it's a there's hope. I tell you, if you're out there and you can't take your migraine medicine because of other diseases, there is a lot of research being done and there's hope for you.
Wow. Okay. So the basic gist, there's not going to be a quiz on all of that and all those receptors and whatnot, but I guess the take-home message is there's a lot of new stuff out there that perhaps if you tried some of the medicines years ago, didn't respond or didn't like them, you know, try again. There's
absolutely
some new stuff. Dr. Wilden, I wanted to ask you, you know, kids showing up with headaches. Oftentimes, let's say two different types. One associated with head trauma. They're playing sports. They come in. Afterwards, they have a headache. They bring them to the emergency room. Versus the ones who, let's say, they wake up in the morning, and in the mornings they tend to have these headaches associated with nausea or vomiting. Do you see, I mean, headaches in kids, is there something specific or different in that setting?
Well, I'm going to backtrack for a second and encourage people who are out there suffering to contact Dr. Davis or Dr. Brewer or other neurologist. On a personal note, I have migraine in my family, and I've had migraines since I was about 10. And I was in residency one time just struggling, working through it, and somebody said to me, "Man, why don't you take a medicine for that?" And I did see a neurologist, and I periodically just use an old school triptan. And if I had to say like one thing in my life that has totally changed it, that it would be the triptan and that advice given to me not to suffer. Because very high functioning people might think they want to work through it. And as my husband will testify, I will go nowhere without a triptan on me. And it really, I will never go back to the days where I suffered through pain unbearably and hid it from everybody. I really think if you're in that situation and you're young and you're healthy and you're high functioning and you don't think you need help, get help. Your life will get a lot better. I really encourage that. From a child standpoint, there are two serious scenarios in terms of headaches that everyone should recognize. One is if your child takes a hit to the head or a hit to the body in general. For instance, maybe they were hit with a hockey puck or maybe they were hit with a baseball. And then maybe they seem fine. And then later they start getting headache. You can have delayed head bleed called epidural hematoma, where you do classically have a lucid interval or a clear interval where maybe your child is fine for a few hours after the head trauma and then headache starts. Any headache after head trauma at any age should really be investigated in the ER. There's really no reason not to do that. A quick scan of the head will rule out or confirm a head bleed. The other situation is if your child is developing new headaches, especially if they're very young, and they are almost always in the morning after the child has been flat and they're associated with nausea and vomiting, that can be a sign of brain tumor. And the other thing it can be a sign of is what we call hydrocephalus or fluid buildup in the head. And sometimes you have fluid buildup in the head due to brain tumors, so you have both going on at the same time. But when you have excess fluid in the head and or a brain tumor, especially in children where brain tumors in the back of the head tend to be more common, you can often have the presentation of headache in the morning with nausea and vomiting. So that's something that definitely should be checked out if it's been happening even for a few days. Again, with our neuroimaging these days with CT and MRI, it's an easy scan to rule out one of those major problems that could be life-saving.
Now, with children, though, even those that have migraines, sometimes they don't really give you a good history. They can't necessarily describe what they're experiencing.
They might not even have headache. There's abdominal migraine that's much more common in children. Sometimes they just get dizzy and vertigo and off balance.
Right. Yawning? Yeah. What about a lot of yawning?
Yawning occurs actually as a prodrome to many migraines in adults and children. That points to a place called the hypothalamus. And so we call that the prodrome. And a lot of different behaviors can occur. And if patients are very, very good at paying attention to their body, they might be able to predict a migraine up to 24 hours prior to it happening.
Yeah.
Dr. Davis, do you think that the onset of migraine is underdiagnosed in children? Because, you know, having been around a lot of kids, you see these kids that they periodically check out from school and, you know, they go to the doctor, there's nothing wrong, they just didn't feel good, and it happens two or three times every month, but it's consistent over time.
It's a really, really tough diagnosis in kids. They only, the migraines in kids only last about 2 hours, and so they could just feel a little puny, lay on the couch for a couple of hours, and then they're going and playing ball. It's, you know, if there's a family history and you get somebody that's kind of, you know, occasionally, intermittently, just not right, yeah, you could get it checked out.
Could they be associated with, let's say, the beginning of the school year or changes in their routine, things of that sort?
There are studies that show there's the Monday morning migraines. There's the, you know, there's all kinds of, and stress is a trigger. Stress is a part of, you know.
Yeah, finals week.
It, so. Yeah.
Sure. Oh, yeah, of course. You know, we only have a few minutes left, and I do want to talk about an area that I think you are particularly knowledgeable about, Dr. Brewer, and that is the use of, let's say, narcotics to treat headaches, treating headaches in people who are, let's say, already taking narcotics for other conditions, people are getting off narcotics and are experiencing headaches. How do you manage folks who have a coexisting headache disorder who have other issues, other health issues relating to narcotics?
Yeah, so I think you're talking about opioids. So
opioids,
drugs
sure.
Like, you know, Percocet, hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, yes. Those types of drugs. If you look at the guidelines for the treatment of migraine headache, opioids are not included in those guidelines. There are physicians who still use them for abortive therapy in, you know, worst case scenarios. Patients are in the emergency room, things along those lines. And I think, Dr. Davis, you can probably attest to this, sometimes that's the only thing that will break a migraine in certain individuals. When it becomes a recurrent pattern or it goes to regular oral use, it's generally not effective. It's not, from our standpoint, it's not what we consider a standard nociceptive pain disorder that's going to basically, you know, be amenable to a functionally, you know, improved outcome. There are some people who have other conditions, like you mentioned, let's say they've had multiple neck surgeries, and they have a lot of neck pain, they use an opioid to control their neck pain, they get off of that, their neck pain gets worse and it triggers migraines, and they may have to get back on the opioid to control their neck pain. The cervical spine and the brain are obviously very closely located, and those pain receptors actually go into the same part of the brainstem, the trigeminal nucleus, that the pain receptors for the meninges go into. And so there are patients who have triggers from the neck that actually can trigger migraine, and there are some migraineurs who have neck pain as a manifestation of their headache syndrome. So those conditions are closely linked, and so the thing that I see most commonly in my practice are patients who've had a few neck operations, and they also have a family history of migraine, and they need to take their medications in order to remain functional. But for an isolated headache syndrome, there aren't that many that we would consider an opioid in. Some patients have a different syndrome called facial pain, which is not a headache syndrome. But if they've had, say, trigeminal nerve surgery, or they've had shingles of the face or the eye, or they have atypical facial pain where maybe they've had some sort of neurosurgery and the trigeminal nerve was damaged, and the only way they can get out of bed and get off the couch is to be on something as strong as an opioid, that would be a different situation. That's a different kettle of fish altogether. But in general, for a typical migraine case, opioids are not something that's recognized to be widely used.
And are there headaches where opioids would be useful, or just not in the migraines?
Well, Dr. Davis, as she mentioned, there are 50 plus, headache syndromes out there. What happens with opioid use in a lot of situations, headaches included, is that they work initially. And then over time, if patients tend to rely upon the opioid for the regular treatment of the disorder, they become sort of immune to it. It's called tolerance. And the problem will break through. If the trigger pattern is not recognized, identified, and addressed, and other therapies are not put into place in general, it's just not going to work. Now, there's a small proportion of the population. It's probably 1%. If they're treated with an opioid for almost any problem, whether it's foot and ankle surgery or migraine, they will trigger the neurological disorder called addiction or opioid use disorder, which means they stop taking the medication for the pain problem, but they're taking it to feel better, to get what we call euphoria, or to release the natural hormones in our brain that helps us to have the feeling of happiness. And that disorder goes out of control. It's like a malignancy of the emotional part of the brain, and those people can escalate their use and die from an overdose. That's an entirely different problem than migraine or back pain or any other problem. But it is triggered with some of the therapies that we use for legitimate medical purposes.
Yes.
I just want to mention, as a rule of thumb, one way to avoid getting that tolerance and medication overuse headache is to only use those abortive treatments, if it's an opioid or a triptan or anything, 2 days a week. If you can keep yourself down to 2 days a week, you're pretty much golden.
Which speaks to preventative therapy. Very good. I'm sorry we're out of time for this evening, but I think this has been a very lively discussion. Lots of good information, and we're gonna have to do this again. And I want to once again thank Elizabeth for calling in with the correct answer to the trivia question. I want to thank specifically again Dr. Deborah Davis, professor of clinical neurology at LSU Health, who specializes in headaches. Dr. Jessica Wilden, neurosurgeon, director of Tri-State Neurosurgery, associated with Willis-Knighton Physician Network. And Dr. Randall Brewer, board-certified neurologist and pain management specialist at River City's Interventional Pain Specialist here in Shreveport. I'm Dr. Sanford Katz, and thank you for listening. Good night, and you will can listen in next week for the next edition of Health Matters.